This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The Deyo Clinic in Dalton, Georgia provides free healthcare services to people with low incomes and no insurance of their own. Over the summer, Heather Donahue became the clinic's executive director in the early months of the pandemic. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're providing this service during the pandemic. You came on board in June. Describe some of the challenges that the clinic has faced since you've been there.
The Deyo Clinic never closed during the pandemic. So challenge number one was staying open, staffing, where a number of our volunteers are retired and needed to protect their own underlying health circumstances by staying at home. We addressed the issues of screening and exposure here at the clinic. We adjusted with a little bit less access to volunteer physicians and nurses, but we stayed open. Challenge number two was helping to treat people who had COVID symptoms without bringing them into the office. We also set up telemedicine early in the summer, but what we were doing was bringing patients into the office and allowing our retired physicians to call in and treat them over the phone. So the visit with the doctor would be the patient comes into the office and the doctor appears on the screen. Many of our patients wouldn't have the technology to do that from home, but bringing in the volunteer doctors through the computer screen was a great way to keep our volunteers engaged and working, and a great way to help our patients see the staff and the qualified physicians that they're used to seeing. And then we knew that we needed to address the problems the larger community was facing. And we were approached by the city of Dalton and some other concerned citizens about helping to make COVID testing more accessible to the same people we've always served. So people who might have issues with transportation, people who might need to access appointments and testing times at other times of the day than 8 to 5. And we began a project with the city of Dalton to do COVID testing. COVID was affecting the Hispanic community differently from everyone else. And at that point in the summer, 80% of the people hospitalized at our local hospital for COVID were Hispanic, which was a very disproportionate number. The medical experts involved and the city and the Deyo Clinic, we all kind of met up together. That our local health department has been very involved in what we were doing. We thought that providing additional times and locations for testing and to provide education in Spanish and to deliver this out to the community was the way to approach the problem. So we set up testing here as a drive-through at the community center in the evenings, from 6 to 8, 4 nights a week. And we started having testing on Sundays around the community. So each Sunday, we would take testing to a different site that reached out into the areas of the community we knew were affected, targeting places where we thought people might be able to walk up from home. If they needed a walk-up test and they didn't have transportation, where their transportation was fairly limited, we were choosing locations out in the community that would make all of that more accessible. Started a little slowly. In July, August, the numbers of requesting patients for their tests were lower. But at the end of October and the beginning of November in particular, the demand for the tests that we were doing skyrocketed. In 2 hours, we would be doing over 100 tests. We began the project as much as we could. We used volunteers, and our volunteers were trained by the health department. We were trained by the health department. We used volunteers to help us collect information from those who wanted to be tested. But as time went on and the infection rate began to climb and the weather started changing to winter, it became a little bit more difficult to rely just on volunteers. We brought on more staff. In the 4 months that we've completed with this testing scenario, we did about 3,800 tests. that were free drive-up tests. We provided other services. We took a lot of information that was available online, and we made sure that we found translations or we translated that information, and we delivered it to the community. We took it out to the smaller stores, the local businesses. They were missing information because they didn't have an overwatching corporate headquarters that was feeding them all the updated guidelines from the CDC. So the smaller family-owned businesses, we delivered the most up-to-date information to them. We kept them plastered in posters about our testing schedule. We even offered to provide them masks if they were running out. We provided masks to people who came through our testing lines. We provided information to the grocery stores, the smaller grocery stores, that they could post in their stores about how to properly wear a mask, how to wash and care for a mask, how to wash your hands. All of this information in a corporate environment where a chain restaurant, the protocols were established that corporate and passed down. But we found that the local smaller businesses needed our help to establish those protocols and to make that information really accessible to them in a way that they could use. We also established a phone number here. Our workers, our volunteers and employees, we call guerreros contra la pandemia, so pandemic fighters. And we established a phone number for the pandemic fighters. People who didn't have a computer at home needed our help to access their test results once they got tested. So we helped people access their results. If they needed some kind of proof of their results, we would print those and allow them to come by our testing events and pick up their results. We really tried to meet people where they were, remove any obstacles that they might have to fighting the pandemic.
And you had a few barriers to break through at once in reaching the Hispanic community. You've spoken about language. Another is the industries that most people in that community work in: construction, food processing, textiles. And then another barrier that you had to face, the family structure. Most people living together at home, you had to face multiple barriers at once in engaging that population to not only get tested, but to stay safe as cases were surging over the summer.
We did spend time addressing how do you quarantine in a home that has more people than rooms, for instance. There's also just a strong work ethic among the Hispanic community here. And so you don't miss work. You don't miss work. And we had to talk through that with some people who were reluctant to quarantine sometimes. We gave out information about how to quarantine at home and how to isolate, and the difference between isolating and quarantining, meaning I need to not expose my family members. I may have been exposed, but what can I do to keep from exposing the others in my home? And another factor that was a significant impacting factor here with the Hispanic population was fear. Early on, people thought a COVID positive test was a death sentence. And they also were so scared to go to the hospital because the fear of the unknown, what's going to happen to me when I get to the hospital? Is it going to be worse? If I'm not sick from COVID, might I catch it by going to the hospital? Many people were waiting so long to go in for treatment that their outcomes were very poor. And so we really did educate people about going to get treatment early. If you have these symptoms and you're having trouble breathing, you really need to go on to the emergency room and be treated while there is still time for intervention. If you wait too long, some of these interventions won't be available and you might go straight to a ventilator. So we educated people on the signs and symptoms they needed to pay particular attention to. And we encouraged people to go to the emergency room early if that's what they needed. We were even able to provide, through the funding that we got, we were able to provide a few households with an oximeter. We made sure they had the instructions for using the oximeter in Spanish, if they needed it in Spanish. We were trying to get along the education about when to seek treatment. And we do feel that although we can't measure it concretely, that the improved results for treatment in the Hispanic community may be a result of this education that we did about when to seek treatment. While we were making sure to specifically communicate with the Hispanic community, we used social media, we used local radio, anything that we could think of. Everything that we did was also provided in English. And all of our testing, all the materials that we had, it was available to anyone. But we were specifically noticing that the community who wasn't getting all the information was the community who spoke Spanish. That was our focus, was making sure that everything available in English was also perfectly accessible in Spanish.
And then when we come to the fall surge, that had a different impact across the board than the surge over the summer. And you've had to operate at a time where the state of Georgia has been very clear about what it's not going to do when it comes to a mask mandate. And the county has been very clear about what it's not going to do when it comes to a mask mandate.
That is true. And so we try to encourage people to think of a mask like a seatbelt. A seatbelt is an automatic safety tool that we use. We don't think about it anymore. I remember when seatbelt became law. I know that people had some issue at that point in time. But under the circumstances that we have, it's our obligation to convince people that wearing a mask is the best option. A mask is still, as we begin vaccinations, a mask will still be one of the very best tools that we have to fight the pandemic. It's one of the best weapons that we have. Under those conditions, what we need to do is to convince people and to give them reliable information from medical sources about the effects of wearing a mask and how in the community, the Hispanic community, everybody wants to protect their family. You have to change the perception in the community away from you're infringing on my rights to you're giving me a tool to protect my family. Why wouldn't I protect my family? Much has already been said about masks, and it is, I am convinced, before the vaccine, the mask and even a face shield are absolutely incredible tools in fighting COVID. And I've proven that to myself by being out at the testing site since August 23rd, and I haven't come down with COVID. And I know that I've been speaking with people who had a higher than average positive rate in our test lineup out here in their cars. But I haven't come down with COVID, and I know it's the mask and the face shield 100% that have kept that from happening. The next mountain that we have to climb is to help people get reliable information about the vaccine. It's concerning that people have questions about the vaccine that aren't being answered. And we know that 80% of the population needs to be vaccinated to really put the brakes on the surge that we're continuing to endure right now. At this point, the vaccine is the most powerful tool that we have to fight COVID. And we need to help people educate themselves about the real science behind the vaccines so that they can make an informed decision on taking it. I took this myself from kind of point zero. How do I feel about the vaccine? What questions do I have and what doubts might I have? And I educated myself and made sure that I got answers. But one of the most compelling arguments was that the physicians that we are working with, they took the vaccine the first day it was available to them. So they aren't pointing to the vaccine and saying, you go get that because it's good for you. They said, follow me. I'm getting the vaccine the day it's available to me, and you should do the same thing. That was a very compelling argument because they were willing to go first, and they absolutely did that.
Have you received the vaccine yet?
We were contacted early by the local health department and included in that sort of 1A group for distribution because we were definitely on the front line. Almost everyone has elected to take the vaccine. And in fact, I've now had my second dose. So we are grateful, so grateful. And some of our volunteer physicians were also able to be vaccinated so that they can get back to this work that they love. If they were retired, they didn't have an office that they're actively working in to obtain the vaccine. And they were able to, as volunteer health workers, gain access to the vaccine. And they couldn't wait to take it because they want to be back here serving the population that they've been working with all of these years.
And for people who want more information about the Deyo Clinic, where can they call? Where can they go online?
The Deyo Clinic has a website. It's deyoclinic.org. Our phone number, 706-581-2009. Those are the best places to get information about Deyo.
All right. Heather, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alicia Leone and Stephanie Martin are the co-owners of Bird Fork Farm up on Kegel Mountain near Dunlap. Their produce is certified naturally grown for the Chattanooga area and beyond, which means they use no synthetic herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, or GMOs in what they grow. Alicia, Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us more about the farm.
So we've been here about 6 months now. We both just moved to Tennessee and found our perfect little farmstead. So we've been working to get it up and running to the point where we can actually sell produce to the public. We really wanted to create a space that we could try and be as self-sustaining as possible off the land while providing delicious, affordable, nutritious produce to the local communities of Middle and Southeast Tennessee. So we're very excited to get to market come spring season.
What brought you to Tennessee?
We've lived on the road for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. We're actually archaeologists by trade. So we've been living on the road for quite a while and decided it was time to try and find our community to settle down. And we just kept getting drawn back to Tennessee. Mm-hmm. After visiting the Chattanooga area quite a few times, we just fell in love with the area and the people, and it helps that there's waterfalls everywhere. So we just kept searching for the property to call our own, and we finally found it.
How were each of you drawn to farming?
So I've been working and volunteering on farms and self-studying permaculture techniques of farming for almost 10 years now. It's not something I always wanted to do, but over the last 5 or 6 years or so, I just have really gravitated towards it and really felt that earth connection of needing to get my hands dirty in the soil and produce something that not only feeds myself and my family, but trying to help others in need that might not have access to affordable produce. And that is really one of our goals, is to try and lower some food insecurity that is in Tennessee.
And Stephanie, how about you?
I'm more new to all of the farming myself. I'm excited about it. I just wanted to find something where I could give more to people. I could do more for people around me. As an archaeologist, it was fun. It filled my 20s and my 30s, and it was fulfilling until it wasn't, but only on a personal level. And the idea of being able to serve people and grow food for other people, it just felt more like what I needed to do. Just opening up avenues for helping people. I think you can help people through food so many different ways that I'm excited to explore all of them.
Alicia, you mentioned permaculture a little while ago. Talk more about permaculture principles and how you and Stephanie are trying to apply them at the farm.
So permaculture is a relatively newish term. It was created in the 1970s to kind of try and capture these overarching principles of agricultural practices tying into social and economic needs, as well as different racial injustices, and really talking about earth and people care as a whole. We utilize permaculture techniques to try to not only steward the land and soil build, but we also want to bring more of the social aspect of permaculture that's often neglected by a lot of people into our farm as well, by creating a safe space that people can come to and kind of learn more about these different techniques, such as swales, capturing water resources, trying to plan out layouts in your landscape that fit the environment you're in, so you're not forcing the environment into a box that it's not necessarily meant to be in. You're observing the environment and you're building based on ways to make the environment work better for you and produce more food in that capacity.
I'm trying to use what's already in the soil. So, like, for instance, a lot of the bigger farms, they use these giant tilling machines and they till up massive amounts of earth just to be able to plant. But what's already in the earth is a lot of microbes and healthy organisms that already live in the earth that help the plants that you want to grow. So we use low-till and no-till ways of creating places to grow that help to use earth natural organisms that are already there to just help.
Yeah, the more you break up soil, the more damage it does to the soil microbes itself. And so we're trying to build up the soil. The farm itself is actually an old homestead. Traditional agricultural practices have been used on it for the last 50 years or so. So we're really trying to just work in that transitionary phase of trying to build the organic matter in the soil to boost the microbes, the healthy bacteria, increase biodiversity. That way we're not relying on outside pesticides or outside resources as much as conventional agricultural models follow.
You have to be just as methodical in making that transition with the soil that has been used to one way of farming for a half century, just as methodical as you have to be with attaining the certifications that you need to operate as a farm and sell the produce that you want to grow.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about what it takes on the certification side, because people listening to us talking in the past few minutes, they just decided to come to Tennessee and set up a farm. It's not that easy, regardless of which method of farming that you want to use.
Yeah, so Tennessee is a little easier in terms of certification processes, but we recently became certified naturally grown, which is kind of an up-and-coming program that is not quite as hefty as the USDA's certified organic program, but it's actually a peer review-based program where other farmers will come in and inspect your farm and make sure that you're growing in sustainable methods or you're using sustainable practices, no pesticides, no herbicides, no non-GMO seeds, using practices that actually aid in building soil life and all those things we were hitting on, but also trying to kind of commit to the community about we're never going to go through these practices. You know that your food is safe with us. So we are proud to say that we are officially CNG certified. As for other certifications, there aren't too many hurdles to jump through on starting a farm, I guess.
If you're going to go pure organic, you know, it says organic this, there are far more hoops to jump through. Being certified organic is actually really difficult for smaller farmers. It can be, it's time consuming. It costs far more. It's easier for larger scale farms to become organic just because of the benefit of having more land, more money, more collateral with the bank to be able to go those extra miles. So smaller farms have a really difficult time being full-fledged organic, and certified naturally grown is kind of filling in that gap for smaller farmers to allow them to say, hey, we're doing this stuff too. It's not called the same thing, but it is the same. It's no pesticides. There are no pesticides, no herbicides. It's all just safe and clean.
What have you learned from other small farmers already in this community as you have come here and have been setting up this farm?
So we're still meeting other locals with the pandemic. That's obviously been a little challenging.
Right.
We have only been here 6 months, but the farmers that we have met in the area have been extremely nice and have reached out about collaborating on various projects and learning different methods from each other. And we're very excited to branch out and learn more from the community.
It is a rather small community. I mean, you think of farms, you think, oh, farms are everywhere. Larger farms, but smaller farms, not so much. And so it's really easy to be like, hey, you're another small farm, let's get together and do this. And so we've started talking to others about potentially doing things in the future and just making friends, really. Getting and just having a sharing of ideas and like, oh, well, we do it this way and we do it that way. And just figuring out what works for the area.
And you are also a woman-owned business.
Yeah, so we're co-owners, and we eventually do want to hire other individuals to assist on the farm. Not quite there yet, but do you think it is very important to support small women-owned, person of color-owned businesses because it really does help strengthen the community and decrease any food sovereignty issues, especially in terms of farming. There is a significantly higher rate of male farmers in the community. So it can be a little challenging, especially when you're talking with outside resources, trying to acquire seeds or plant starts in nurseries. There are some biases that can come along with it, but why not break the glass ceilings?
I have a little niece and I'm really excited. She's excited for the farm and I'm excited to show her that we can do this too. Women can get out here and we can grow and we can sell and we can do all the things that we need to do to run the farm. And it's just being a good example for other little girls to grow up. You don't have to be a certain gender to do a certain thing. They can do it. I can do this thing that I want to do. It's nice to be an example, to set an example for the next generation.
And you mentioned food sovereignty. We talk about that. We talk about food insecurity. You both, having been here for at least 6 months, you are aware of the food insecurity throughout this area, not only within Chattanooga, but also in the small towns beyond Chattanooga. Talk to me more about what you have seen.
The grocery stores in the areas, I mean, there's one or two. You know, you have a Save-A-Lot or a Walmart, you know, you live in a town and you've only got access to two places to get food. And you go into these places and their produce comes from other countries, other states far away. It is limiting in what you can buy here, what you can get that's fresh. There are some produce stands and some farmers markets, and that's awesome, but it doesn't reach everybody. And we're really looking to try and reach into the gaps, into the more underserved areas, the people that can't get out even to go into town to go grocery shopping sometimes.
Yeah, so staggering 21% of Tennesseans don't actually have access to affordable, healthy food. And even in the city of Chattanooga, there are food deserts. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that's just unacceptable, especially in larger cities when there is a wealth of food. There are disparagingly large quantities of people that are left behind. And, you know, there's so many processed foods or fast foods that are cheaper and easier, and they're easier to access, especially in those food deserts. But it doesn't mean that all people don't deserve fresh, high-quality produce. In those food deserts, we live in a food desert. We're outside of Dunlap right now. There is often a lack of knowledge about how to go about actually cooking some of those vegetables. So one of the things that we really want to do to try and tackle part of this issue is not only donate a large portion of our production to local food banks, but also to do educational outreach where individuals can come to the farm and see how food is really grown and put their hands in the soil and get school groups out here to connect children with the food. Because if you start from a young age and put those connections together, it really helps close some of those gaps. That is just really one of our largest goals, is to try and not only make food more accessible to people, but to show people it's not as hard as it seems, it's not out of reach, it's attainable for everybody.
And that there are options, there are options out there.
And where can people go online to follow everything that you do?
So we're currently only on Facebook and Instagram. I'm sure we'll get a website built at some point. But if you search for Bird Fork Farm, there were no birds or forks harmed in the making of our food. But you can find us on both Facebook and Instagram and keep track of where we'll be selling in the future.
Mm-hmm. All right. Alicia, Stephanie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Andrew Nyberg is a poet and a lecturer on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. His collection of poems, The Goats Have Taken Over the Barracks, will be released in March. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Tell us more about this book.
Well, I've been working on it on and off for almost 10 years now. Half of the piece is set on or in or around Tennessee, and the other half is set on East Island, Croatia. And in a lot of ways, the story of the collection is one of self-discovery, of understanding how somebody's identity can span to such different areas that also have a lot of similarities between them.
Tell us about a few of the similarities.
Well, one of my favorite parts of living here in Tennessee is the living in the foothills. I grew up in New Hampshire, so I kind of always was accustomed to the sight of mountains, and it was very welcoming here in Tennessee to see something very similar, but honestly, a great deal warmer. Croatia also is characterized by low mountainous terrain. The brush is a little bit scrubber, a little drier there, but I felt like the topography had a lot in common. I saw a lot of very similar creatures, the same types of insects, and as a result, the aesthetic of being on the island felt a lot like sitting in the foothills on a hot Tennessee night.
Tell us how and why you came to tie these two very different places together.
Some of it comes back to one of my instructors when I was really trying to establish myself as a poet, the author Art Smith. He was always a huge inspiration for me. He taught at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and passed about 2 years ago. I communicated with him throughout the course of the composition of this entire collection, actually. A couple of the poems even began in his classroom. And one thing that Art had always encouraged very strongly are large associative leaps and trying to make meaning out of those connections. And so early on, as I was starting to form my identity as a poet and thinking about experiences I'd had that might relate, both my attempts to acclimatize myself to the Tennessee environment and then also discovering my heritage in Croatia coincided really strongly with each other. When I first moved to Tennessee, actually, I very much missed New Hampshire, and it took some time for me to decide that I was a Tennessean. And so I started having these two sort of central elements to my identity. And to some extent, I simply wanted to forge a connection between those, to sort of pull these two halves of myself together. And that became, in a lot of ways, a central project of this collection of poems.
And this is your first collection of poems. When did you know that you had something here that was capable of being a collection?
Oh, no, that's a tough question. So this is my first full-length collection of poems. I did have a chapbook of poems called Easy to Lose, which was a book of conversations I wrote sitting out on my front porch with insects and frogs and things like that that I would see around me. And this new collection had started in a very similar way. Initially, the chapbook was, again, a conversation with small creatures. This one was more a conversation with summer nights, is the way I would put it. And so I started pulling those elements together. So I composed a number of poems that were sort of related to that theme, using a lot of heat images, images of things like the birds I was watching. Various cicadas are a pretty heavy theme in my work. Then I started, as I was also composing separately, kind of scattered poems set in Croatia, I started noticing another overlap, which was images of heat, and especially heat at night, and listening to the sounds of nature around me. And a couple of key poems had started to pull the thing together. I realized even that I had a couple of poems I'd written here in Tennessee that could just as easily have been set in Croatia if I had named the specific places. And so that was kind of the marriage point. And so there were a couple of particular poems that really stood out as the anchors or the connections between the two halves of the book.
You touch a lot on fragility in this collection.
Well, in a lot of ways, I've had a fairly fortunate life in that I've not experienced a great deal of personal losses. So my immediate family, for example, has had very few disasters. I've known a lot of folk who've lost friends to accidents, unexpected illnesses. And of course, you know, this is 2020, which would change that even further. But as a whole, though, I lost one of my grandparents to cancer. There was a very long time coming. My grandfather on my mother's side also died of a heart condition. But again, these were all expected losses. And at the same time, I always felt like I was watching people around me from an advantaged position where I was lucky to have these things not affecting me, whereas so many people I was surrounded with had just devastating losses. And I often sort of helped people through as a, you know, listener or friend as they were struggling with various different major crises. And so it just became something I spent a lot of time thinking about. And I felt like I was watching it from afar, but that also kind of always kept it on my peripheral vision. And a lot of my poetry is very observational in nature, where I will pick something in my environment to write from. So I'll sit out on my porch a lot of nights and just look at a streetlight and decide to make that the subject of my evening's thoughts. When I traveled to the island in Croatia, I'd sit at the cafe and watch the water, or I'd sit on the pier at the other side of the island and just look at the mountains and things like that. And then I just begin writing on those subjects. And so I really started to see all of these things, like my life seemed really stable and strong, but I saw all these things around me that made it feel really brittle and like the slightest wrong breath could just suddenly shatter everything.
As you were compiling this collection, which poets would come to mind? Which verses from other poets would come to mind?
Well, this collection definitely had a couple of guiding poets. I did mention already Art Smith in the collection, The Fortunate Era. Honestly, to me, in some ways, it's my poetry Bible. It's the one that really inspired me to, I don't know, see my aesthetic in a particular light of how I worked with images and ideas like science and nature. But I also was a tremendous fan of the work of the late poet Jack Gilbert. I was fortunate enough to have him as a guest instructor at UTK. He was one of the first poets who I really just fell in love with as an author, where I would just revisit his collections, The Great Fires and Refusing Heaven, over and over and over. And whenever I was doubting what I needed to do next in a poem, I'd open one of those books to a random page and be like, okay, so what did Jack do? Also, he was a poet of isolation as well, which in some ways has always struck me as worth pursuing as an observational poet. But then both James Wright and Robert Hass were huge inspirations as well. And then I studied under a trio of poets while I wrote most of this collection. Kathleen Driscoll and her collection, Laughing Sickness, was pretty influential. And then I was working with Deborah Kang Dean and Molly Peacock as well. I would say in a lot of ways, even though there's very little formal poetry in this collection, my work with Molly Peacock, where I studied form under her at Spalding, was enormous in shaping my decisions for how these poems were presented on the page. So there was a lot of different things I was reading, but those were kind of the big ones. Mostly Jack Gilbert, Art Smith for sort of my aesthetic, but then I learned so much about craft and technique from Kathleen, Deborah, and Molly.
And we should explain, without giving too much away, the title of this collection.
Up on East Island, Croatia, there's two mountains that the body of the island is made of, and the village sits in the center of the two mountains. On one mountain, there's a small church, and on the other, there's an abandoned military outpost. One of the reasons I decided to set, or I was so fascinated by the setting, was the almost immediate metaphorical connotations of one mountain having the church and one mountain having the military. I couldn't help immediately seeing some resonance between the image there. But the abandoned military outpost has since been overrun by a large herd of goats, and all of the doors and windows are broken out, so they just move freely in and out of the buildings. They sleep on some of the broken down, discarded furniture. Honestly, to a certain extent, there's just something wonderful about the image of something harsh, like a military barracks, just being reclaimed so thoroughly by living creatures and the natural world.
What do you hope people who read this collection take from it, especially during these times?
Probably the biggest thing, coming back to the sense of fragility, would be a reminder, first off, of our fragility, that as strong and capable as we are as a species, that we are surrounded by a world that dwarfs our capabilities with its complexity. As much as we understand the vastness of everything around us, I mean, our knowledge has yet to reach the corners of it by a long shot. But also just a respect for that natural world as a result. I don't want us to be frightened of the awesomeness of nature. I do think that it's important for us to build a relationship with nature, and that requires respect and feeling like we are a part of it and not something that should be setting ourselves against it. Especially in the modern day, as we see so many people fighting against science and fighting against fact, you know, I really hope that people can see a positive message about how we can interact with the world and not be overrun by it.
And where can people go online to keep up on all that you do beyond the collection?
I do run a Twitter and Facebook page. My Twitter handle is at Andrew Nyberg, and you can look me up at Andrew Nyberg Author on Facebook. I do keep a regular series of posts on both. And the Facebook series is primarily focused on presenting images of East Island to help people understand the context of the book, as well as some of the history of the places that appear inside it. And I'm actually planning on running a new series shortly, once that one exhausts, about places in Tennessee that the poems are set as well. Also, I do have a few recorded videos of readings of poems on YouTube. I've most recently posted a couple of poems, one called Fighting for Me, one of my favorite poems I've composed called Reverence, which was about the University of Tennessee Knoxville's body farm. It's always been one of my favorite pieces that's had sort of a near and dear place in my heart.
All right, Andrew, thanks so much.
All right, thank you very much.
Next Thursday at 6:30 p.m. on Zoom, Andrew will read from his collection, joining fellow poets Jeff Harden and Jesse Graves for an evening of poetry. Details on Andrew's website and Facebook page. The Performing Arts League here in the Chattanooga area supports young people who want to participate in the performing arts. Tomorrow and Saturday, from 3:30 p.m. to 9 p.m., the League and UTC's Performing Arts program will share online a video showcase of young performers, featuring actors, dancers, instrumentalists, and singers, to help raise money for the League's mission. Greg Miller is the League's president. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Remind us of the mission of the Performing Arts League.
Well, our mission is to promote youth involvement in the performing arts, and we do this by supporting important projects and opportunities of young performing artists, both individually or as a part of a group.
A few examples.
We raise funds during the course of the year, and we hand out a number of scholarships for various programs so that students can take classes in the summer months to keep up with their talent. We also hand out grants in the form of money towards specific projects. This past year, we contributed money to the CCA's piano lab in the formation of that project. We also contributed toward the youth orchestra's purchase of percussion instruments this year. In the past, we've done things like we contributed funds to the Lower Lookout Valley school system to purchase band instruments. We even gave money to the Kiwanis Club to help them build a musical park, if you will.
And you now are sharing a showcase of videos where people can see these artists and their work, but also to raise money for the Performing Arts League.
That's correct. Normally, we do this as a live event. We've done this for 7 years, and normally we do it in conjunction with UTC's Performing Arts Department. It's done live at the Roland Hayes Concert Hall at UTC, but this year, obviously, we couldn't do that. So what we did was put together a collection of videos from all of the various organizations that we normally have in that performance, and we're offering it online.
Give us a sampling of what we might see, without giving it all away, of course.
Well, there's a lot. The program is about an hour long. We have 9 different organizations. We have dance. In the dance, we have Chattanooga Ballet performing the Sleeping Beauty Suites. We have the Civic Ballet performing Waltz of the Snowflakes and A Life Yet Imagined. The Barger Academy The Movement Makers is performing their Christmas magic. And we have the Chattanooga's Indian Cultural Dance Troupe performing a Bollywood melody. And for vocals, we have, of course, the Chattanooga's Boys Choir doing How I Can Keep From Singing, Chattanooga Girls Choir performing Tennessee Home and Carol of Bells. And in the theater, we have the Chattanooga Theater Center Youth Theater performing excerpts from their performance of Lion King Jr. And the Christian Family Theater performing excerpts from their performance of the musical adventures of Flat Stanley and Aladdin Jr. And lastly, for instrumental, we have the Chattanooga Symphony and Opera Symphony Youth Orchestra performing Nimrod from Enigma Variations.
What's it like to work with these organizations as they have had to adjust, as the Performing Arts League has had to adjust during this pandemic?
It's been a shock. Our organization just kind of collapsed. We raise money by doing social events, and that's kind of hard to do in a pandemic. So we've been sitting back and rethinking how we're working. And most of the organizations that we work with are doing exactly the same thing. Some are doing much better than others. I know the Chattanooga Boys Choir has done a lot of work fine-tuning how they practice and how they perform so that they can do it safely during the pandemic. And as you'll see in some of the performances in our event, you'll see performers wearing masks where appropriate, and they continue on. I think the programs that are probably hardest hit right now are the ones that are in our public school systems, because they don't have the same resources that other organizations have to adapt to an online presence.
Have any of the works that you mentioned, any of the works in all of the videos that will be shared, have any of them been inspired by, reflect this age that we now live in?
I think the performance you'll see from the Chattanooga Boys Choir is extremely reflective. It was done to show exactly how they're working during the pandemic and how they're doing their practices. You'll see a lot of that in that performance. About half of the performances were recorded during the pandemic, and half of them were actually video from before the pandemic.
And then where can people go online to view these videos, to keep up on everything that the Performing Arts League is doing?
The event is being staged out of our website. That is palchattanooga.org, palchattanooga.org. And right on the front page, you'll see a link that'll go take you right to where the presentation will launch from. We also have a presence on Facebook. And I actually also have an email list. And if anybody's interested in getting our monthly newsletter, just drop us a line through the website and I'll add you to our email list.
All right. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a quick mention. On Saturday at 11 a.m., Bob's Boot Camp returns to the Chattanooga Symphony and Opera. Bob Bernhardt, the principal pops conductor, will present a new course online titled Music for These Times, a Pandemic Playlist, sharing some of his favorite works that can bring joy, even now, especially now. Details at chattanoogasymphony.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.